The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. College romance has blossomed into a profound 27-year relationship and 18-year marriage. When the Supreme Court dismantled Roe, we knew queer couples like us probably had much to fear, that no one's rights were safe. What we didn't expect was just how directly Justice Thomas's concurring opinion would prove us right. In it, Justice Thomas says that cases that paved the way for gay marriage should be reconsidered. Some pundits will even say that it's a good thing and that gay marriage should be debated again, that these issues should be part of a democratic process decided by voters state by state. But I already know what it's like to live in a world where human rights are bestowed by minority rule. I've lived during a time when I had to accept that I would be forced to live a smaller life in order to share it with someone I loved. I know what it's like to have employers, city officials, banks, hospitals, even my dog's veterinarian, force me to affirm my relationship in a multitude of taxing, expensive, and humiliating ways, only to get a quarter of the respect and rights that straight couples received. The idea that soon our lives could be legally invalidated, both as women and as a queer couple, hurts my heart. But the cruelty is the point, isn't it? When I met my wife in 1995, gay marriage wasn't a thing. It wasn't even in our realm of possibilities. In fact, for Magalie and me, both of us Latinas, our coming out stories involved hesitation from our families that was deeply layered. Marriage meant something to us, and it was a tradition that was deeply rooted in our Latina heritage. Our mothers both said some version of, "You're already an immigrant's daughter. You're already Latina. You already come from a poor family. Why do you want to make things harder on you? You're never going to have a family. You can never get married. Don't choose this life." When Magalie and I were undergrads and wanted to move off campus, we had to file for the equivalent of a domestic partnership so that our relationship would be recognized by the school. At 19, this was a lot of complex paperwork to navigate, but it was important for us to signify our commitment to each other. After graduation, we moved to Cambridge and had to file for domestic partnership again in order to put our names on our apartment lease as partners, not roommates. When we moved to Boston, the same paperwork was waiting for us yet again. We even legally changed our last names, both of us hyphenating to reflect both of our original identities and our new ones as spouses. In 1999, this was the only legal way we could convey partnership, even if only symbolically. And that's the thing about marriage equality. It's not just the legality of it that matters. It's the little things that help you build your life together, like holding hands in public, saying my wife, or checking into a hotel and not having to explain why you don't need a room with two beds. These are things that straight married couples don't have to think about. We lucked out that Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we moved after college in 2004, was the first city in the nation to legalize same-sex marriage. Magalie and I rushed to City Hall to make it official. The ruling was so unexpected that everyone we knew was in a hurry to get a marriage license out of fear the ruling might be quickly reversed. I remember how it felt on the steps of City Hall, where a crowd gathered to support us. Some handed out bouquets of fresh lilac and spring flowers as we joined 262 other couples who waited to enter the building. At 12:01 a.m. on May 17th, the doors opened to a municipal celebration. There was white organza on the wooden staircases, a wedding cake in the lobby, and sparkling cider near the clerk's office, and the Cambridge Community Chorus sang from the council chambers. We were joyful about finally being able to make that commitment in writing to each other. We called our family to tell them the news. We held hands. Yet even with our joy, there was always this feeling that the ground could crumble underneath us at any time. After same-sex marriage was legalized nationwide with the Obergefell v. Hodges Supreme Court decision in 2015, which just so happened to coincide with our 20th anniversary, we felt like we were finally on solid ground. We even held a long-delayed wedding party and read pieces of the court's decision in our vows. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. We were recognized. We were seen. We were valued. not just by each other now, but by our society, our laws. It is important for people who have never had their bodily autonomy or intimate relationships up for public debate and approval, listen to those who have. This is not a Twitter argument or an academic exercise. This is the fight of our lives. This is about fairness and dignity. These days, I often think of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. quote, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." My entire life, I interpreted those words to mean that justice was a law of nature, like gravity. Its progress slow, sometimes maddeningly so, but still always arcing for movement toward the good. Today, however, I realize the constant is not the arc itself, but the people who ensure it takes the shape of fairness, of equality, of love. The constant is us. Our next article by Margot Mifflin is titled, "I Learned What a Father-Daughter Relationship Is from My Husband." My father died when I was 10, and my memories of him barely fill a paragraph. He's watching me tool around on a plastic fire truck as a toddler. He's on the porch serving fried chicken on my birthday. He's calling, "Hey, Joe," to a salesman the day I get the Schwinn Stingray I later crashed in the woods. He's buying a Halloween pumpkin. He's singing "You Are My Sunshine." He's smoking Pall Malls on the lawn one summer night, letting me stay up while the others sleep. And finally, he's surrounded by boxes, shambling around the charmless apartment he never quite moved into after my mother divorced him, months before he died of cirrhosis of the liver. It's true, my dad drank himself to death, but that's not why I didn't know him. He wasn't a mean drunk or a binge drinker who disappeared from his children's lives. On the contrary, he was sociable and engaging, I'm told. For Contour, who approached Ted Williams on a train platform in Baltimore in 1954 and talked him out of quitting baseball. I can't say why I don't remember him. Perhaps it's because most 60s dads weren't as involved as they are today, overseeing play dates and attending back-to-school nights, or because I'm the youngest of five and there was only so much attention to go around, or because his job as a Pennsylvania state legislator required travel. The impact of his absence is deeper than the imprint of his presence, but less palpable. I love the smell of nicotine on men and cry when I hear "You Are My Sunshine," probably because of my dad, possibly because of Willie Nelson. I have the vague but certain sense that he was kind. When she was young, my daughter, who nearly lost her father to cancer at exactly the age I lost mine to dry martinis, asked whether I ever missed my dad. She called him Eddie, and clearly wanted me to say yes, but the answer was no. You can't miss someone you never really knew. A close friend has what I consider a perfect father, loving and present, responsible and open, a new model dad I've known since my own father died. I observe their interaction with anthropological curiosity and shameless envy, and yet when I think about children who've lost a parent, it's the motherless ones who strike me as truly tragic. My mother was the one who endured. She packed her kids into our station wagon when I was almost 9 in the summer of 1969, the night after we watched the moonwalk on TV, and took us on a road trip to California, determined to show us a good time before we were flattened in the domestic train wreck she saw coming. She helped us pick up and move on. Because of her, I marvel that anyone can have a shred of self-esteem without a mother's guidance. But it turns out there's more to fathers than I knew, much of which I've learned from my husband. When my daughter calls him Daddy, a diminutive I never used, she owns him. A dad who taught her to cook and play chess, who made sure her first live concert involved fierce women playing loud guitars, whose presence is woven in her history. Her dad is real. Mine is a character who long ago shaded into fiction, a reconstruction mostly from other people's memories, which far outnumber my own. Notwithstanding whatever demons made him drink, from being adopted by emotionally distant parents to ferrying bombs across Europe during World War II, my father and I might have enjoyed a nice relationship had he lived. I saw him for the last time in a dream when I was 21. He was driving our family down a steep hill in a snowstorm as my mother touched his arm and told him he was going too fast. I awoke with a jolt and briefly felt his presence. An existential flash, a wave, an acknowledgement, perhaps even an apology. not so much for what had happened, but for what had not and never would. Our next article by Robin Moreno is titled, The Stages of Grief Explained and How to Cope with Loss. Grief is a fundamental part of the human experience, something we will all experience in our lives, whether we are mourning the death of a loved one, the passing of a loyal pet, or the end of a relationship or job. And since the pandemic, grief has come to the forefront as people are finding more and more things to mourn. Grieving is an experience that can happen with the loss of a loved one, a relationship, or even the loss of a dream, says Paulina Isabel Amorosa, MSW, LCSW, and founder of Latinx Grief. People experience grief around profound transitions like moving, divorcing, or saying goodbye to careers, neighbors, or ways of life, adds Ladinia Garcia, psychologist and host of the Beyond Resilience Life podcast. So how can one make their way through this tough period? It's less about dealing with grief and more about feeling your way through, says experts. In her seminal 1969 book, On Death and Dying, Swiss-born psychiatrist and co-founder of the hospice movement, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, outlined her seminal five stages of grief. The American Psychological Association describes the five stages as a hypothetical model depicting psychological states, moods, or coping strategies that occur during the dying process or during periods of bereavement, great loss, or trauma. These begin with the denial stage, followed by the anger stage, bargaining stage, depression stage, and acceptance stage. Not everyone who is grieving will experience all of these stages or in this exact order because grief is not linear, says Almarosa. Grief is circular. You can tap in or tap out of any of these phases and more. Grief is also very personal, and while no two people will grieve the same way, these classic five stages of grief will be recognizable to most in the grieving process. Here's a closer look at each of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief. Denial. Consider the first of the stages. The denial phase is a time of shock and disbelief when your body can't quite take in the reality of your loss. To some, this might look like the soldiering on with work and social life in spite of what's happened. This phase brings to mind the stoic widow at the funeral memorial who was holding it together for everyone else while insisting, "I'm fine." Anger. As you begin to process your grief, the illness, the passing of a loved one, the loss of the 20-year job, or the end of a marriage, feelings will start to rise, with anger boiling to the top. You might ask yourself, "Why is this happening?" or exclaim, "This isn't fair." Or you may direct your rage at your old boss, ex-lover, or God himself. Anger is a normal and expected stage of grieving, and it's important to understand that anger is the broad umbrella term for the many rivers of feelings flowing underneath. Because grief is not linear, people might circle back to anger again and again as they grieve, says Alfie Breland Noble, psychologist and founder of the AAKOMA Project. I wish people knew that there are multiple ways to grieve, says Breland Noble. It's not just cry, get over it, and be back at work in 2 weeks. Bargaining. Feelings of guilt, blame, and shame, and thoughts of if only and what if come up as grief unfolds in the bargaining phase of the mourning process. This chapter of grieving is when your logical mind is struggling to control the situation or make sense of an insensible occurrence. This might look like praying to God to undo what's happened, or feelings of regret as you replay a scene again and again, looking for a different path that could have led to a different outcome. Not everyone experiences all these five stages, nor do they come in this particular order, so never worry that you've skipped a stage. You might stay longer in one phase while never experiencing another phase, only to cycle back to an all-too-familiar phase again, and it's all okay. Depression. Rather than lashing out, denying, or trying to change what's happened, the depression stage feels like sadness and despair as you face your present reality. Feelings of depression might cause you to lose weight or withdraw from friends or social activities. Life might lose its color as you wonder, what's the point to all of this? Grief is actually longing more than sadness and sorrow, says Almarosa. Our brains are used to patterns, so your brain wants that cup of coffee you had every morning with your spouse. But with time, the longing will quiet, says Almarosa. It's important to note that depression is a natural process of grieving and differs from mental illness. Depression becomes a disorder when it is managing you and you are not managing it, says Breland Noble. If you can't get out of bed, if you can't stop the sadness, or if it's impacting your ability to function day to day, then you might want to find a professional who can help you find the tools to cope with your life, she says. Acceptance. The acceptance phase means coming to terms with what's happened and accepting it as reality. While this phase can offer some peace and relief, it should not at all be confused with feeling cheery. Grief.com says simply, finding acceptance may be just having more good days than bad ones. Elizabeth Kübler-Ross said this of grieving, the reality is that you will grieve forever. You will not get over the loss of a loved one. You will learn to live with it. You will heal and you will rebuild yourself around the loss you have suffered. You will be whole again, but you will never be the same. Nor should you be the same, nor would you want to. So now that we know about the stages of grief, how do you move through each stage? There are no shoulds in grieving, says Nadia Janevsky, licensed art therapist, LCAT, clinical director at NY Creative Art Therapists. So try and have lots of self-compassion for all the phases and stages that arrive, even if they seem weird. Observe thoughts like, I should be over this by now, or I should be crying. The truth is, there is no wrong way to grieve. How can we best support a loved one who is grieving? It's better to reach out and say the wrong things than to not reach out at all, says Janevsky. Get your cues from grieving persons. If they don't want to talk about it, no worries. If they want to chat and make morbid jokes, just go with it. It's important to keep being the same friend and leave space for your friend or loved one to show up where they are. Everyone deserves space to grieve the way they need, adds Breland Noble. So ask permission to check in and listen with intention and love so you can act on what they tell you, not your interpretation. A lot of people get disconnected because their suffering might trigger something in you, warns Garcia. Sometimes the best way to help others who are grieving is to sit with your own suffering so you don't have to try and change others' feelings or their situations and just be there for them. How long will I grieve for is a question many people ask. Grief is like a wave coming at you big and fast at the beginning, but then the waves get smaller and the tides slow down so the feelings aren't as powerful and you can let them wash over you, says Janevsky. There is no time limit to grieving, says Garcia. Psychologists have created a new pathology called prolonged grieving disorder, which, according to the New York Times, was designed to apply to a narrow slice of the population who are incapacitated, pining, and ruminating a year after a loss and unable to return to previous activities. Many psychologists find fault with pathologizing, but if you are struggling months and years after a loss, you might want to talk to someone. Not everyone who is grieving needs a therapist, says Almarosa. But when you feel your personal resources are not enough, when you just can't find the skills to get yourself unstuck, it might be time to reach out, she says. And be aware of anniversaries, which can activate feelings, adds Garcia. What resources can I use to move through grief? Turn to art, write a poem, make a collage, paint portraits of your cats. Art can be a great way to move through grief. It holds beauty and pain, and you can express things you haven't been able to express while also memorializing someone or a thing, says Janevsky. I recommend grief books and websites like What's Your Grief?, The Duji Center, Refuge in Grief, says Almarosa. I'm also a big fan of journaling. Even if you write down just one word a day, which could be angry, try and be curious about your thoughts and feelings in your mind and body. Balance out feelings of sadness and emptiness by connecting with people and in engaging in activities that bring you joy and pleasure, says Janevsky. If you're a runner, start with a walk and be around people who can support you so you don't have to pretend. While it's hard to imagine, grieving can be a time for growth. Grief changes and transforms. You're never the same person, says Almarosa. It can be tragic, but it can be an opportunity to find parts of yourself that you didn't know were there. Some people experience post-traumatic growth, where you're somehow able to find a new sense of meaning and appreciation that actually allows you to grow as a person, says Janevsky. They begin to appreciate life and think, I'm not messing around anymore. I know myself now. It's a time of resilience. It can be very powerful if you can access that transformation. The most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of the depths, said Elizabeth Kübler-Ross. These persons have an appreciation, a sensitivity, and an understanding of life that fills them with compassion, gentleness, and a deep, loving concern. Beautiful people do not just happen. Our next article by Amanda Robb is titled, When Expressing Empathy is About What You Don't Say. I swear on the Thelma and Louise video we watched into a scratchy oblivion. I didn't mean to be the worst friend ever. When Lisa, my roommate and boon companion of 3 years, stepped into our apartment, sank to the floor, and clutched our cocker spaniel, I asked, what's wrong with sympathy? I got fired, Lisa told me. Wow. I pulled her to her feet. You'll have an amazing story for Jim's party tonight. Lisa's eyes went round and wet as the dog's when we left her at the vet. She said, come on, Maya, who gave me a reproachful glance before obeying, disappeared into her bedroom for 3 days, and never discussed career matters with me again. Boy, was I annoyed. At age 26, I was a sublime friend. Lisa, also 26, was blessed to have an ally so honest about dates and hairstyles, so fiercely supportive of her dreams and willing to defend her choices, the dates, hairstyles, and dreams, to her habitually nettling mom and dad. Never once in our relationship, I was proud to think, had I ever been tempted to commit a single mortal friendship sin, being competitive, gossiping, or backstabbing. To me, Lisa's job loss was no big deal. She had complained about the position. Her parents were rich and gave her money. She had nothing to worry about. I thought that reminding her we had something fun to do that night was an appropriate and kind response. Psychologist Douglas LeBeer, Ph.D., director and founder of the Center for Adult Development in Washington, D.C., disagrees. He explained to me that my dearest friend was humiliated by receiving a pink slip, feared she might be incompetent at everything she tried, and because of me, felt utterly alone. I was, LeBeer tells me, catastrophically unempathetic to Lisa. Today, 15 years later, I know why my attempt at consoling my friend was so ham-fisted. As LeBeer explains, virtually everyone learns the basics of empathy in childhood, from our parents comforting us when we're in distress. But my father died when I was 4, and afterward, my mother had to be very can-do, juggling 3 jobs, graduate school, and 2 kids. When I was upset, she never said, oh, I'm sorry, it must be hard to have me away so much after losing your dad. Instead, on good days, she'd say, why are you crying? Nothing is wrong. And on bad days, you better toughen up because life can get a lot worse. Looking back at my 20-something self, I realize that if, as LeBeer says, empathy is the ability or the willingness to experience the world from someone else's point of view, I wasn't brought up to be able to do that. At least my lack of empathy was not unusual. Having practiced as a psychotherapist for 35 years, LeBeer believes that what he calls empathy deficit disorder, or EDD, is rampant among Americans. LeBeer says we unlearn whatever empathy skills we've picked up while coming of age in a culture that focuses on acquisition and status more than cooperation and values moving on over thoughtful reflection. LeBeer is convinced that EDD is at the heart of modernity's most common problems, macro, war, and micro, divorce. When Lisa crept into her bedroom, I couldn't have articulated any of this. She might have felt abandoned, but all I knew was that I felt alone. My roommate had her dog, and they were both shunning me, and my boyfriend of 4 years wouldn't rescue me from the loneliness I increasingly felt by agreeing to get married. I went into psychotherapy. I thought my therapist would help me break up with my commitment-phobic lover, figure out how to choose less sensitive friends, and of course let me rant about my mother's shortcomings. I did get to rant about my mom, Lisa, and my boyfriend. What surprised me was my therapist's response to these tirades. She never said, "Leave that rotten bastard," or "Your roommate is a big baby." Instead, she said, "Gosh, that sounds really hard, and that must have felt terrible. And how did you feel after that happened?" My reaction to those spectacularly bland comments was even more astonishing. I loved them. These very simple responses make you feel understood, says New York psychologist Frank M. Lachman, Ph.D., author of Transforming Narcissism, Reflections on Empathy, Humor, and Expectations. He points out that many of the common responses, "It could be worse," "You should do X," "Let's talk about something else," appear to be kind and aimed at soothing. But no matter how well-intentioned, Lachman says, these remarks are a rejection, a denial of what the other person is going through. They are code for "don't confront me with things that are unpleasant," he says, or "don't bother me with your pain." About 6 months into psychotherapy, I started using what I thought of as my therapist's lines. When Lisa was offered a job at an organization she did not want to work at, I said, "Oh, that's a tough spot to be in." When my boyfriend was invited to study abroad, I said, "How do you feel about that?" What I really felt was, "Lisa, that job pays a ton of money, but I guess you can turn it down because your parents are loaded. And you selfish bastard, I'll kill you if you go to Europe without me." Still, Lachman says, I had taken the first step to becoming empathetic, which is faking it. If you want to act more empathetic, you follow certain steps. Instead of telling people what they ought to do or becoming tyrannically optimistic, you offer sympathy, inquire about feelings, and validate those feelings. You'll be giving comfort to the other person, even if you yourself can't feel what they're going through. It's true that for a long time, while I could say the appropriate thing, I could not relate to their struggles. Still, I took satisfaction in the fact that my relationships were improving. Then a year after starting therapy, I began feeling something intensely when comforting friends. Terror. This turned out to be a signal, Lachman says, that I was actually feeling empathy. I didn't recognize it because I'd always run from emotional discomfort. And at least in the beginning, I found trying to be empathetic profoundly uncomfortable. Most of the time, I managed to avoid the impulse to blurt out unhelpful suggestions to my friends. "Happy hour, anyone?" Or "Here's the number for a credit consolidator." And instead say the appropriate thing. But for years and years, I could stand genuine empathy only 5 minutes at a time. For those 5 minutes, though, I was not alone. And once I had experienced the wonder of that, I was willing to stumble out of my comfort zone to try to not be alone again. Virtually everything I've ever tried to improve about myself, my weight, my sleep habits, my house cleaning, has resulted in an endless seesaw of improvement. But empathy, I've learned, is not like dieting, or at least how I diet, which involves ending up back at square one. Cultivating empathy has its own rewards. The more you do it, the better your relationships are, and the more you want to continue. Feeling understood in that therapist's office taught me that human beings are not doomed to be alone, and empathy is life's connective tissue. If you have a romantic partner, he or she will someday believe that you are entirely wrong about something. And if you could see the problem from your partner's point of view, you'll be able to get through that conflict without smoldering in the corner or splitting up. If you work with someone you despise and who despises you back, and you try to understand why that person dislikes you, then you stand a chance of not hating every minute with her at the office. If you live in a world that you would like to see less divided by ethnic, economic, and religious strife, you'll find that attempting to comprehend the needs of your sworn enemies is a prerequisite to any meaningful action you could take. Empathy will also require you to get past rationalizations and admit wrongdoing. For about a decade after I started working to be more empathetic, I told myself that I hadn't hurt Lisa too badly because she never told me I had. But Lachman points out that the final insult of being treated with a lack of empathy is that the hurt person usually can't complain. If you say, "That was such an unempathetic thing to say," it can easily be heard as, "Feel sorry for me." And no one wants to be pathetic. So most people don't say anything, Lachman says, and relationships are often ruptured and ruined. Lisa and I are no longer close. We live on opposite coasts. We have very different lives. But still, I couldn't bear the idea of us being ruptured and ruined. I recently called her and said I was sorry for being selfish when she lost her job. I said I had eventually learned that it must have been a terrible time for her and that I had made it worse by leaving her so alone with all her confusion. Lisa was gracious. You did your best. Forgiving. Really, you were a wonderful friend to me overall. And honest. It was 15 years ago and I'm over it now. She changed the subject and we caught up on our summer plans. Her family, along with the Cocker Spaniel Maya, who was still alive and giving reproachful looks, was planning a camping trip. Packing up, Lisa realized none of her jeans fit. Her pregnancies had stripped every curve from her body. She was skinny as a post. I began to wail. Oh my God, you lucky rat. I gained 10 pounds. But then I stopped myself. So how does it feel to have to buy new jeans? I asked. There was a silence on the line. Then Lisa started laughing. Wonderful, she said. Absolutely wonderful. Our next article by Amy McHugh is titled, Sleeping Apart Improved My Marriage. My husband and I haven't slept together in over a decade, and we're still happily married. Sleeping separately began during my then 4-year-old daughter's bout with cancer. My husband volunteered to sleep in the guest room and get up to give her medicines throughout the night. A pang of guilt made me hesitate for a second, partly because it didn't seem fair and partly because the decision felt like a reflection on my roles as a good wife and caring mother. But I was an edgy, sleep-deprived zombie, so I quickly agreed. Just for now, I promised, and meant it. The first few nights, I lay half awake waiting for one of our daughters to call me or for my husband to creep in with a question. But they didn't. When my alarm went off in the morning, I wanted to cry, not because I hadn't slept well, but because I had. As the days rolled into weeks, our bedroom became my sanctuary. With the door closed and the chaos of the world on the other side of it, I could breathe. My self-help books and novels balanced on both nightstands, and my blue yoga mat was allowed to stay along the foot of the bed. I filled journals, flipped through magazines, and examined rogue hairs on my chin. My sound machine hummed and the air conditioning blasted. When I was restless, I watched Call the Midwife or read a book with the light on. Night after night, I slept uninterrupted in our big bed, feeling anything but lonely. My mornings became magical in my own space. I threw up the shades, flushed the toilet, made the bed, that my husband never did, played something from my Spotify list, and watched the birds while I brushed my teeth. These were little freedoms that turned out to be really big and allowed me to start the day focused on myself. Before my daughter got sick, it didn't even occur to me that my husband and I could sleep in separate beds. Most nights he crawled into bed after midnight, which woke me up. I'd lay awake and run through a list of to-dos while listening to him snoring and the incessant pinging of his phone notifications. Every night I'd suffer through because, after all, what was the alternative? But by morning I was ready to kill him. I'd unknowingly pick arguments about any number of things, including his dirty mouth guard on the bedstand or the clothes he left sprawled on our bed. It's hard to be a good partner when you're sleep-starved, says Wendy Troxell, author of Sharing the Covers and senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation. You become moody and you're more prone to depression and to engage in conflict. Sleep isn't only necessary for your individual health, well-being, and productivity, but also vital for the health of your relationship. It was. Now when my husband came in the kitchen every morning for coffee, I looked forward to seeing him. How'd you sleep? Was the first thing we asked one another. Wonderful, I'd say, and if for some reason I didn't sleep well, he had nothing to do with it. It made me love him more. The weeks rolled into months, then after a year and a half of sleeping apart, my husband asked, when am I coming back to the big bed? I let the words hang in our kitchen for several seconds. My heart pounded. The question was inevitable, but still I wasn't ready. The well-rested version of me was a better woman and a happier one. Soon, I said, not meaning it, and biding a little time. As I saw, we were benefiting from the best of both worlds, sleep and sex. Weekend nights after we put the girls to bed, we binged Netflix in my bed. Sometimes we listened to music, sipped tequila, and romanticized about where we'd go when we weren't at soccer games or birthday parties. Sex wasn't always a part of it, but we were having more now than when we slept in the same bed. The more I slept, the more I was up for sex, and it didn't feel like just another thing to do. Plus, as I found out in my spare time in bed alone, an extra hour of sleep for women results in a 14% increase in sexual frequency, and our relationship was benefiting from that. Didn't he realize how lucky he was? But no, at the time, my husband saw it differently. Our daughter's health had improved. He felt it was time for him to sleep in our bed where he belonged, he said. But I just couldn't. A recent YouGov survey of more than 12,000 adults found only 2/3 of Americans want to share a bed with their partner. Yet many continue to, in part, because of a social construct that's based more on fashion than facts. We allow society to come into our bedroom and dictate what may or may not be working for a couple, Troxell says. It's crazy because none of it's backed in science. Back in the 1800s, couples slept apart because of concerns about hygiene as part of the domestic sanitation movement, when society at the time became obsessed with cleanliness in an effort to prevent the spread of epidemic disease. Then in the 1900s, marital advice author and birth control advocate Marie Stopes came along, rallying against sleeping separately, saying that it was endangering the happiness of the modern married couple. It took a while, but by the 1950s, separate beds indeed started to be seen as a sign of a distant or failing marriage. When priorities and values shifted in the 1960s, younger couples cemented this idea and started to view separate beds as a symbol of complete dysfunction in the marriage, and sleeping apart fell totally out of vogue. My husband, a part of this sleeping together is awesome ideology, was still having his doubts, letting societal views mar the beautiful reality of what was actually happening in our marriage. One Sunday afternoon, now 2 years after we slumberly departed, we sat on the wooden floor of my bedroom and shared our concerns about sleeping together and sleeping apart. Mine, I didn't want to go back to sleeping next to him because I was happier and no longer cranky and resentful. His, he didn't want to be known as that couple whose marriage lacked intimacy and eventually fell apart. I get it, I said. But, I explained, sleeping apart wasn't a sign that our relationship was on the rocks. Rather, it was a sign that we had an open, healthy, and communicative relationship, one that had improved when we stopped sleeping in the same bed. It was actually a sign of strength. And it was. It didn't suck the romance out of it. It held us accountable to each other. Our time together felt more intentional than planned. It embodied the best parts of our relationship, the laughing, touching, and connection. We left the chaos and strain of kids, work, and who was taking the dog to the vet to be hashed out outside of the bedroom. Says Ken Page, psychotherapist and host of the Deeper Dating podcast, how you handle sleep issues in a relationship is how you're going to handle every other charged issue in your couplehood. Communication becomes key. Maybe sleeping apart isn't forever, but it is for now. We'll continue to have open and honest conversations about it in a loving and respectful way. Then we'll retire to our rooms for a good night's sleep. Our next article by Lee Haber, Wadzani Moot, and Hamilton Kane is titled, Here are the 2022 Pulitzer Prize Book Winners. The announcement of the Pulitzer Prizes is a rite of spring, rich with both pageantry and gravitas, as we celebrate the previous year's outstanding achievements in journalism, music, criticism, cartooning, and books. The five categories of fiction, poetry, history, biography, and general nonfiction shine a beam onto the scholarship and creativity that enrich us and define our humanity. Often decades in the making, these works educate, augment, and entertain as only the written word can. This year's winners offer vital perspectives at a moment of grueling transition and potentially grave consequences. One painter's account of his life, conveyed not only in words but also in his canvases, evokes a rural corner of Georgia where the cruelties of Jim Crow were tempered by a vibrant, resilient Black community. Two historians examine the contradictions of American politics through the lenses of indigenous justice and our fraught relationship with Cuba. An inventive, searing novel traces one family's shadow across the Jewish experience, while a superb nonfiction narrative captures the hopes and despairs of a neglected Brooklyn girl. And who says a poet can't teach a strict form like the sonnet Fresh Tricks? The United States has struggled through a year like no other, our lives an endless scroll of breaking news and bold-faced headlines. Not since the 1960s, and possibly the Civil War, has our republic seemed so fragile and ill-equipped to wrangle the challenges ahead, from COVID to climate change, to international conflict, to human rights at home. But one thing's for sure. Books, such as those honored by the Pulitzer Prizes, are our best tools to make sense of it all. Number 1, Chasing Me to My Grave by Winfred Rembert is told to Aaron I. Kelly. Biography. A gorgeously illustrated retrospective of the black folk artist who died in 2021, plus a wrenching memoir of the Jim Crow South. A peer of the great Mose Tolliver, Rembert grew up in rural Cuthbert, Georgia. His vibrant canvases evoke the honky-tonks of Hamilton Avenue and convicts laboring in sun-scorched fields. Number 2, Invisible Child by Andrea Elliott, general nonfiction. Andrea Elliott, a reporter at the New York Times, began chronicling Dasani's life in 2012, having met the 11-year-old girl in the homeless shelter she'd moved to in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. In her Pulitzer-winning Invisible Child, Elliott writes unsparingly about the realities of life in shelters and the trajectory of children in that setting. Through the history of one family, Elliott examines how racial and economic disparities produce generational poverty. She puts a face to statistics, and in doing so, challenges our assumptions about poverty and resilience. Number 3, Covered with Night by Nicole Eustace. History. A historian vividly recreates a fateful crime in 1722 when two white men assaulted an indigenous hunter in Pennsylvania, just as British colonists and Iroquois leaders were sketching a treaty for an uneasy peace. From the aftermath of this little-known event emerges fixed notions of crime and punishment, the burning question of whose thumb commands the scales of justice. It's equal parts true crime page-turner and an essential contribution to the canon of our history. Number 4, Cuba, an American History by Ada Ferrer. History. Ada Ferrer is a historian and child of Cuban immigrants who fled to Miami in the 1960s. From the first Spanish settlement, the slave trade, and the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, to Cuba's influence in African countries, she writes a nuanced story of the complex history between Cuba and the United States. Ferrer's comprehensive exploration of Cuba, the Cuban people, and the shifting relationship with the United States helps us understand both countries' histories and the ties that continue to bind them together. Number 5, Frank, Sonnets by Diane Seuss, Poetry. In her lithe, unsparingly fifth collection, poet Diane Seuss reimagines the sonnet as conversational confession, dispensing with strictures of rhyme to probe the burdens of love and selfhood, the compulsion to see art as a whole, with images playfully plucked from everyday life. Intimacy unhinged, she writes, believe me, I didn't want it anymore. Who in their right mind? And then it came like an ice cream truck, with its weird tinkling music, its sweet frost. Number 6, The Netanyahus by Joshua Cohen, Fiction. The Netanyahus turns the conventions of the campus novel on its head as a narrator, Reuben Bloom, an elderly American historian retired from Corbin University in the bucolic hinterland of New York, looks back on a pivotal year at the end of the Eisenhower administration when he played host to an exiled Israeli scholar whose family would transform the fate of the Middle East. There's a wry Talmudic tone to this playful, ingenious work. As Reuben muses, dreams are involuntary. Every tradition believes this, from the neurological to the numinous. Some dreams are held to be prophecy, while others are held to be nonsense, which is prophecy yet unmanifest, those waking dreams indistinguishable from yearning. Our next article by Sheila Weller is titled, Sharon Kreitzer and Dave Ashley are saving lives by finding kidney donors for veterans who need them. Oprah Daily's series Good People Doing Great Things highlights everyday heroes who see a need and are stepping up to help. It's the end of the first week of April, National Donate Life Month, And Sharon Kreitzer, founder and executive director of Donor Outreach for Veterans, or DOVE, is beaming. One of her donors, Lindsay Gutierrez, an Air Force vet, was just cleared to give her kidney to a transplant recipient in dire need. She was crying with joy when she learned that she could give back that way, says Kreitzer. I've seen in a short time how this has taken hold. This is the nurturing community Kreitzer, 53, has grown over the last 2 years to help veterans in need of kidney transplants. As an administrator in a U.S. Veterans Affairs Department, or VA Transplant Center, for 4 years, and a professional working in the field of organ transplants for nearly 25, Kreitzer witnessed firsthand the layers of bureaucratic obstacles that meant some patients died before they were able to receive transplants. At the same time, she was moved by the strong feeling of brother sisterhood and the Leave No Soldier Behind bond that united the veterans she served. For Kreitzer, the aha moment was realizing the impact she could have on this community as an advocate and a navigator, becoming the bridge connecting those in need with those who wish to give. In January 2020, just before her 51st birthday, Kreitzer founded Dove. And in just 2 years, amid a global pandemic no less, the nonprofit had facilitated 13 kidney transplants, with 6 more scheduled in the next 3 months. 26 more donors are in the evaluation phase. Working from her home office in Montclair, New Jersey, where she lives with her children, Nathan, 9, and Naomi, 11, and her partner, Thomas, Kreitzer explains the problem Dove is trying to solve. Veterans have a higher incidence of kidney failure than non-vets. Of the 96,000 Americans currently waiting for kidney transplants, most will have to settle for a donation from a deceased donor, and the wait is about 5 years, which many will not survive. The answer, says Kreitzer, is donation from a living donor, in many ways a superior option. These kidneys last longer, she says, and the transplants can take place as soon as a match is found. No need to wait for a compatible organ to become available when another patient passes away. But there are precious few kidneys currently available for live transplant, since responsibility for obtaining a living donor is on the recipient. Says Kreitzer, can you imagine how hard it is for someone with a chronic, debilitating condition to garner the resources to ask for a donor? That's where Dove comes in. Kreitzer's organization connects with veterans who need transplants and presents their stories on its website, whose tagline is, encouraging people to give so vets can live. The question for those who visit is bold and direct. Will you step up? Unlike other transplant networks, Dove not only encourages but facilitates opportunities for donors and recipients to meet, which is often highly gratifying for the donor. Several years before Kreitzer founded Dove, Dave Ashley embarked on his own path to donating a kidney. It was the summer of 2016 when Ashley, an active Air Force colonel and frequent consultant to the Pentagon, saw a fellow West Point alumni's Facebook post, a plea on behalf of a friend named Chris who was in desperate need of a kidney transplant. Ashley saw the post and was moved to act. I just thought being a donor sounded like the right thing to do, he recalls. Step one was discussing the matter with his wife, Diane, and digging into research how losing a kidney might impact his life. Ashley reached out to people in the competitive sports communities he participated in, adventure racing, mountaineering, ultramarathons, asking whether anyone could share their experience with him. None of them were living kidney donors. Still, he decided the risk was worth it. Ashley contacted his West Point friend, who put him in touch with Chris's transplant agency. Over a 2-month period, Ashley underwent extensive blood work and diagnostic testing to make sure it was safe for him to donate and to determine whether he was a match for Chris. After the medical transplant team cleared Ashley and confirmed the match, he asked to speak with Chris, who shared his own harrowing journey. Chris shared with Ashley that he had lost his job, moved in with his parents, had had sepsis, and nearly died. At that moment, Chris was prepared to wait 3 to 7 years to receive a kidney from a recently deceased person, if he could live that long. According to Ashley, Chris's condition improved dramatically within weeks of the transplant. And by 2018, a year after receiving Ashley's kidney, Chris was back at work and doing well. The experience of having saved Chris's life was powerful. I thought I was giving a gift and asking nothing in return, says Ashley. Instead, he had received an equally life-changing gift. I reevaluated my life. Ashley decided to retire early from the military and launched Adventure Kidney, an organization that raises awareness about the need for kidney transplants and aims to ease concerns about having an active lifestyle post-donation. Says Ashley, now 47, there's nothing you can't do with just one kidney. You can do amazing stuff. In Ashley's case, amazing stuff has meant dedicating himself to climbing the highest summits on each of the 7 continents in the world within a year and with only one kidney. This past March 25th, he scaled a 6 of 7 summits, Mount Kosciuszko in Australia. It took me about 7 hours passing a poisonous snake, getting scratched by the underbrush, seeing the beautiful country of Australia, says Ashley. Then the sky seemed to widen and he could finally see the top. Tears were coming out of my eyes from just knowing I had a chance to be successful. He is set to scale Mount Everest this month, determined to prove, through its final climb, just how much one can accomplish with one kidney. Dave Ashley and Sharon Kreitzer, Adventure Kidney and Dove, are two parts of a solution. Ashley inspires, Kreitzer implements. And now, together, they make it possible to match living kidney donors with recipients in need. 6 months ago, Kreitzer connected with Ashley after seeing one of his Instagram stories. He was just extraordinary, Kreitzer says. I wanted to know him. Ashley is now on Dove's board of directors, and he and Kreitzer are working together in their complementary ways to decrease the transplant wait list. Kreitzer hopes that when Ashley finishes his Mount Everest climb, his story will inspire others to become donors and to bring in much-needed funding to their transplant initiatives. For the past 2 years, Kreitzer has dipped into her personal savings to fund Dove. I first had to show that my veteran-centric kidney donation model would work before organizations would want to fund it, says Kreitzer. My first check came from Freedom Mortgage Corporation in February for $5,000. And with Ashley's influential network of contacts, the two hope to grow that funding base quickly. Dave's a great spokesman and advocate for veterans' issues. He's a connector, says Kreitzer. Our combined efforts have the potential of making a difference. After Ashley returns from his Mount Everest climb, he and Kreitzer, who have met only virtually so far, will celebrate in person. Lindsay Gutierrez's operation will be happening soon. When I found out I was approved to be a donor, I felt like shouting my excitement from the rooftop, she writes in an email. It was a surreal moment that has forever changed my life and will change someone else's. Thank you, God. Gutierrez will be helping a young Marine and plans to meet him just before or after the operation. And another recent announcement has prompted cheers in the donation community. Kreitzer made the decision to become a donor herself. She began the qualifying medical testing this spring and, if cleared, hopes to donate by the end of the year. In my work in healthcare, I have always treated every patient, every caregiver, as if they were my own family, Kreitzer says. It is that simple. That is the way I lead my life. That is the way I want my children to live theirs. We can solve big problems in communities, not in isolation, she adds. We are all in this together. Our next article by Adrian Farr is titled, Jumping Double Dutch Brought Me So Much Summer Joy. As a kid, I couldn't wait for summertime. There were about 15 children on my street, and we played every childhood game you can imagine. Freeze tag, relay racing, Simon Says, Mother May I, and so much more. But my favorite summertime outdoor activity, besides getting ice cream from Mr. Softy, was jumping double dutch. As early as 6 years old, I had memories of hearing the click-clack of the rope hitting the gravel of my street. Are you right-handed or left-handed? The older girls would ask newbies in order to determine which side they should be jumping in on. I'm a righty, so I took my position on the right. Eventually, I learned to do tricks, pop-ups, the typewriter, crisscross. I also loved when we split up into teams and I had to jump with a partner as everyone counted aloud rapidly to the beat of our feet. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. All the girls and some of the boys on the block would jump for hours every single day until I was in my late teens. Double Dutch is so ingrained in me as a basic childhood joy that in my early 20s, I taught it at an after-school services center in Harlem. Every little black girl should know how to jump double dutch, I said to the director when I pitched the class. She agreed, and I taught it to girls of varying races the entire summer. They grew to love jumping just as much as I did. The years went by, and my time became filled with the anxieties that adulthood brings. From time to time, I'd hear about an adult double Dutch class in passing, but I never took the time to investigate. This summer, though, I couldn't ignore the double Dutch content that kept popping up in my Instagram and Facebook feeds. I watched the videos with nostalgia and then saw that there was a Facebook group called 40 Plus Double Dutch Club, and these women were getting down. They were jumping rope the way I remembered. I joined the page and asked if there were any meetups near me and was thrilled to find that there was a group that meets every Saturday about 10 minutes from my house. I promised myself I'd go and pushed away all the noise in my head telling me I had too many things to tend to and that I was out of shape. Nope. Be gone, incessant negative chatter. Last Saturday, with my daughter in tow, I went to my first session. As I entered the park, I legit could have cried when I saw the women jumping and heard the beautiful and familiar sound of the rope hitting the pavement. They were so welcoming, with big smiles and hellos from everyone. I have to admit I was nervous, but I booted the nerves out of my system and moved to the right side of the ropes to get ready for my first jump in more than 2 decades. The rope click-clacked beautifully, and off I went. I jumped. And I did pretty darn good, if I do say so myself. I jumped again, then had to chill out because I thought I might pass out. I got congratulations all around, including from my daughter, who said, "Mommy, you did so good." I'll be jumping double Dutch as many Saturdays as I can, along with my daughter, who is learning how to jump straight rope and will eventually graduate to double Dutch. When I think about the story she'll tell her kids one day about her early experience with double Dutch, it makes me so proud to know that I'll be an integral part of her nostalgic accounts of summer fun. I might pass out. I got congratulations all around, including from my daughter, who said, "Mommy, you did so good." I'll be jumping double Dutch as many Saturdays as I can, along with my daughter, who is learning how to jump straight rope and will eventually graduate to double Dutch. When I think about the story she'll tell her kids one day about her early experience with double Dutch, it makes me so proud to know that I'll be an integral part of her nostalgic accounts of summer fun. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.